Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Newton's lawyer. And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad brothers!
Free the Soledad brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson,
sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today. Yeah, my heart.
Starring Gary Dorden from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Viva Fidel, long live Fidel. The recent news of the illness of Cuban President Fidel Castro has unleashed a ghoulish glee in Miami and also in the White House. The spectacle of people dancing in the streets of Miami at news of Fidel's sickness was disgraceful. Few of us who have grown up under the propaganda that passes for the corporate media have any real idea of either Castro's or Cuba's immense social accomplishments while under the threat of U.S. invasion and destruction. As a student of history, I'm often amazed at what we don't know about other people, even those as close as Cuba. If Americans truly supported democracy instead of dictatorships, the name Fidel Castro may never have become known to us. That's because Castro, as a young man, newly graduated from law school, endeavored to run for the Cuban Senate as a clean government candidate. His platform opposed political repression and corruption, and how major Cuban institutions had been bought off by the U.S. mafia elites. He spoke out against vende patrias, or sellouts, among the politicians, and also denounced the press because journalists were being bought with botellas, or bribes. He opposed the corruption of the dictatorship's courts. Guess who the U.S. supported? The U.S. supported the dictator, of course, Fulgencio Batista, a man who was legendary for his brutality and his corruption. Given the legal challenge posed by the young Castro, his election was scuttled by the Batista regime, and Castro learned that there was no legal way to oppose the regime. The U.S. has always preferred its own brutal puppets to Democrats, and has done so on every continent in the world. What we also don't hear about is the actions of the U.S. against Cuba, which can only be called terrorism. Under either Operation Pluto, Operation Mongoose, or Operation J.M. Wave, the U.S. has bombed factories, plotted overthrow, planned and tried to carry out assassinations, worked with organized crime, destroyed crops, and other crimes. The famous Church Committee reports unveiled several assassination attempts against Fidel, which were coordinated with the mafia dons Marlansky, John Roselli, Sam Giancana, and Santo Traficante, all of whom owned businesses on the island. Before the Cuban Revolution, the island was called a mafia paradise, for the mafia leaders owned casinos, nightclubs, whorehouses, and also legitimate businesses, like banks, airlines, TV stations, and newspapers. In 1 8-month period alone, in 1961, the CIA committed 5,780 acts of sabotage and terrorism against Cuba, including several attempts to assassinate the Cuban president. The U.S. supported repression, brutality, and corruption, forced Fidel and millions of other Cubans to become revolutionaries instead of Democrats. And once a revolutionary, it forced him to become an internationalist, supporting freedom struggles all around the world. In late 1975, when armies of the racist regime of South Africa invaded Angola, it was Cuba that sent 18,000 troops to assist the beleaguered African state. By year's end, Cuba's 36,000 soldiers, with their Angolan allies, bested South Africa in the field, forcing them to retreat for the first time in the history of apartheid. It was, Fidel would later say, an African pit-on, a reference to Cuba's battlefield victory over the U.S. in the Bay of Pigs. The U.S., of course, supported the South Africans and several brutal terrorist armies, the FNLA and UNITA. While it may be true that Fidel is ailing, it's also true that he and the revolution that he helped lead has been a force for good in the world, on the side of the oppressed, not the oppressors. It has been on the side of freedom, not slavery. Consider, if you will, how many people in Vietnam, in Chile, in Argentina, in South Africa, in Iraq, in Palestine, have suffered needlessly because of the actions, exploitations, support of dictators, secret wars of repression by U.S. presidents over these last 50 years.
Viva Fidel. That was an excerpt from Prison Radio with Lamia Abdul-Jamal. This is Rafiki Jamel, one of your hosts tonight, and I want to welcome you to George Jackson University Radio, where our main objective is to transform the American prison system into the largest university in the country. This type of transformation within the prison system will elevate the consciousness of our brothers and sisters, or as we say in the New African Independence Movement, Indigu, Kaka, for brother or Dada, sister. So it will elevate their minds of the incarcerated. Each and every day we should learn to grow and transform our minds and become new men and new women. And by doing this, we will also transform those around us. And I emphasize new men and new women. We must become a force for change. And all over the world, there has been men and women who came out with that determination and conviction for progressive change. Like we just heard, Fidel was one of them. Ho Chi Minh was another. Men such as George Lester Jackson, Big Jake Lewis, James Carr, Jeffrey Katari Golden, W.L. Nolan, and many more have served as examples of new men and new women, martyrs of the prison movement. Before we get started, I just wanted to bring out one of the excerpts from Fidel Castro's prison diaries. It starts as, "With the blood of our dead brothers, I write you this letter. They are the only motive that inspires me. More than justice and liberty and life itself, we are calling for justice for all of them. Justice this instant is neither a moment to the is neither a monument to the heroes and martyrs who fell in combat, nor to those who were murdered in the battlefield. Justice is not even a tomb where they can rest in peace together with the bloody remains that are spread over the fields and in places that in many cases are known only to their assassins. It is not possible to talk about peace for the oppressed in this land." Now we will bring on our other co-host, Bumani Shakur. Bumani, are you on, brother? Actually, we will save Bumani for last. Right now, we're going to bring on Sister Moon. Moon, are you on?
Peace, yes.
Peace, Dada. You can go on and introduce yourself.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Moon. I am
I was born and raised in Dallas. I'm a nursing student at a university here in Arlington. And I'm here to help out, do whatever I can to make everything go smoothly, to get the information out. And I'm standing in solidarity with you and everyone else. And I appreciate the time and allowing me to be here.
Indeed, sister. We appreciate you too. Comrade Bumani.
Yes, sir, comrade. Jumbo. Jumbo, comrade. Free land. Revolutionary greetings. Mabari Regani. African liberation through African love. I was listening to what Muhammad Abu Jamal was saying about the brother Castro. You know what I'm saying? Long live the spirit for that Castro. The brother was a stalwart soldier for the liberation of African people. And he contributed to the efforts of the African liberation struggle, especially the African independent movement, the liberation movement for years. And there's still a lot of brothers and sisters who are benefiting from the work and labor that their brother put out toward our liberation of our people and the Latin African connection. I'll let you free all the political prisoners. Shout out to everybody in the Shakira family. Shout out to the Sunni Ali family. Shout out to all the OG, Seiko and Dingo. Bilal, Sunni Ali, Tatiero, the list goes on and on. It's always a pleasure to be on this platform, to be on the education platform, Georgia University Radio, where our mission is to transfer the criminal mentality to a revolutionary mentality, to a new African mentality, to educate you from being an educated individual from a colonial mind state to a new man, a new mind, a new woman, or what is a new mind state, as a new individual, as a new being, so that we will realize that we can use education to liberate ourselves from the oppression and servitude and neocolonialism, or whether colonialism, and some of us suffering the best neocolonialism, to liberate ourselves, to gain independence, to be self-determined. Tonight in the broadcast, we'll have Dr. Jerry Ball on. His brother's a multiple talented genius, an educator, a husband, a father, a professor, an author, a media specialist, a producer, a director. He's a jack of all trades, but he's a master of none. I'd like to bring him to the show with you, Dr. Jerry Ball.
It's a pleasure. I got to start with one correction. I'm definitely not a genius, but I'm definitely trying to contribute, and it's a pleasure to be on with all of you.
True indeed, brother. You're a genius, brother. It's in your genes, man. It's in your African genes, man. You already know the history. You already know the history of our development, and we're the masters of the various sciences and geometries and philosophies and arts and poetry and music and arts. We the masters of all that. How you doing tonight, bro?
I'm as good as could be expected, and again, I appreciate being invited on to this impressive platform.
True indeed, brother. True indeed. Can you tell the people a little about yourself, a little about your background, where you grew up in, and how you came about?
Well, long story short, I was born in D.C., grew up in Columbia, Maryland, got into some trouble, joined the military to avoid the legal system, and it was in that four-year period that the seeds that had been planted previously took some roots, and I began to study and seek some sort of political home after that experience. And have been looking to work with folks in my adult activist life with Organized Coup, the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, looked to build with various formations, work with political prisoners and in support of political prisoners, try to develop some alternative radical media and teach some of that in the process, and try to do some multimedia work and learn from some others and get more into not only professionally, but in terms of personal political practice, as many multi-forms of media as I think we can put to use for this kind of struggle.
Sure indeed, brother, sure indeed. I'll go on over your bio, and I see you made a lot of contributions to our liberation. You have accomplished a lot of education endeavors to educate the people. You have made a lot of accomplishments, you know. You did a lot of work. It's so much to go over and to go into. First, I'll let it ask about your professorship at Morgan State University. Now, it say you're a professor of media Africana studies. Can you give us a little insight into what exactly do you teach at the university?
Well, I teach a variety of classes. It changes a little bit each semester, but essentially the work I try to do is blend radical critical approaches to the study of media history and media studies, rather, with my previous personal and educational experience in Africana studies. And, so any class from basic introductory courses in media literacy to some graduate courses on emancipatory journalism, the purpose is more or less always the same, just to increase, as best I can, the students' ability to think critically and understand a little bit about their Black and African history that ways that is not often taught. So I do teach, Morgan State, for those who may not be aware, is an HBCU in Baltimore, Maryland. And many of our students, come from the city of Baltimore or similar cities and communities in the area and around the country, and some from around the globe, most of them of African descent. And it's in many ways perfect for me and, most appropriately apply my particular training and set of interests.
Okay.
Well, but essentially, George Jackson's basic philosophy guides my own. In Blood of My Eye, he said that, for a revolution, we need an underground army, an alternative political party, and an alternative or underground press that would promote the concept and ideas of revolutionary struggle. I'm not in a position to participate in or even advocate the military part, and don't necessarily advocate that portion of his analysis be, primary in people's public conversation, other than to let people know that that was what George was advocating. But I do try to do work in developing alternative political parties and underground and alternative media that is designed to promote the value of revolutionary struggle. So that's the sort of ethic and philosophy I try to bring to the classroom.
Okay. Yeah. My next question is, what inspired you to create the mixtape George Jackson Releasing the Dragon, and what exactly is the purpose of it?
Well, the longer form of the story is that when I was in the military, I used to get books passed to me by some older brothers who were trying to help me along. And I noticed that in the front of the book, there was many of the books, rather, was a stamp for a bookstore in Baltimore, Maryland called Everyone's Place, which is still there on North Avenue. And I grew up in the area, but Baltimore was never really my city, and I had never been there. But I remember being, you know, but I'm seeing these stamps on books while I'm sitting out in the middle of some ocean somewhere. And it occurred to me that when I got home, I needed to go to that bookstore. So that's one of the first things I did. And one of the things that I noticed there was that they had a lot of cassette. You know, this is in the early 1990s when they still had a lot of audio cassettes. And I used to get audio cassettes, and I had a job delivering pizza. So I would spend a lot of my time delivering pizzas listening to lecture tapes from Dr. John Henry Clark to Marimba Ani to Francis Cress Welsing to Wade Nobles to Chek Antijop to Theophile Obenga to, of course, Malcolm X, Dr. James Turner, Angela Davis, Assata Shakur. So I'm listening to all of these lecture tapes. And then the other thing that I would split my time with was just regular hip-hop mixtapes that I would get from either New York or wherever I was getting them from. And it just occurred to me over time, I just was like, this is the kind of radio I would want to listen to. You know, I want to hear a mixtape blended with the lecture tape, historical and political content. So, you know, a few years later, when I was looking for an approach to study, academically, actually, that's not true. Actually, before that, when I was joining a political organization, Organized Coup, one of the things we started doing was creating mixtapes to distribute in D.C. as a method of not only expanding the range of some radical political art, but our own interviews and journalism. And we were combining them and creating these journalistic mixtapes. And I thought that at the time was a good way of developing alternative methods of communication and alternative methods of political organization. And I ended up writing about it and going from there. So at one point, I wanted to do a George Jackson tribute mixtape. And in 2006, we did one where I just had people read quotes from George Jackson, and then we put beats under them and blended it with some radical music and went from there. So when I took this temporary gig at this supposedly alternative media operation in Baltimore, I got to link up with this brother from Baltimore named Bashi Rose, a brilliant videographer. And I said to him, you know, one of the things I want to do while I'm here is create a video version of that George Jackson mixtape. George has become one of my favorite thinkers and writers. And I wanted to find another way to expand his work. So the point really was to find ways to make radical media that not only introduced people to George Jackson, but to try to introduce people to the ideas that he was working with and his philosophy of study and struggle and organization. And that was really the goal, to again, just produce the kind of media that would perform the function that George himself called for, as best we could, and inspire people to think differently and, of course, organize around that new form of thought and build from there.
Okay. My next question is, I'd like to know your thoughts on how relevant is teaching as Comrade George in the modern day reality right now.
I'm sorry, you said how relevant are the teachings of George Jackson right now?
Yes, sir.
Well, unfortunately, they're exceedingly relevant. I mean, everything that he said was happening is still happening now and is maybe intensified. The conditions that he was dealing with when he was writing in the late 60s and into the very early 70s are either the same now or objectively worse. So when you're talking about, you know, whether he was, you know, his prescient argument that fascism was already here, you know, people are talking about Trump is the rising fascism. Well, George was saying that 40 years ago. And,
yep.
So there's that. Then if you just look at any of the material conditions, whether it's, you know, the report that just came out the other day, the gap between black and white income is back to 1950s levels. You know, globally, Oxfam said 1% of the population of the planet has more wealth than 99% of the rest of the percent of us combined. Militarily, the United States is in everybody's backyard and has armed the African continent to destroy itself. There are ongoing wars that this country's first African-descended president has extended beyond even what his predecessor had done, bombing at least seven African and Middle Eastern countries, so-called Middle Eastern countries, and helping overthrow at least a potentially, if not already there, revolutionary African leader in Libya. So, you know, who was looking to develop a pan-African currency. So, again, if we look at the conditions that George himself was dealing with most specifically, mass incarceration, while it's true that the incarceration rates for black men is slightly going down, the incarceration rates for black women are going up. The expansion of the prison system into privatized surveillance, in-home surveillance, is already expanding. To the extent that people are correct, there is a rise. Already we've seen a rise in violent attacks of whites against black people around this country after Trump's election. And we see the struggles of indigenous and Chicano and Latin American people in this country, and even poor whites that George was looking to in some ways encourage new forms of organization. So all of the conditions he was looking to address are still there. And in his specific analogies of colonialism and relating black America as an internalized colony to the United States and recognizing the need to protect itself culturally and politically, geographically, etc. I mean, all of these things are still, again, unfortunately, pressing issues. So his analysis is exactly what we need. The concern that I have is that not only is his analysis or related analyses, not only are they so difficult to penetrate into broader audiences because of the pervasiveness of the most powerful media system and dominant media system the world has ever seen, not to mention its economic system and social system and policing system and surveillance system and all of that. But the conditions are themselves worsening. So as the conditions get worse, we are it feels like in many ways being pulled farther and farther away from the analyses that we need, as it's so easily done that I think, you know, whether we want to call them false prophets or just people with whom we disagree, there is so easily placed pundits and other leaders who can walk us back from the kind of conclusions and calls for organization that George and others like him represent. So, So George is as relevant as anyone, and if anyone is looking for a philosophical or analytical approach to interpreting their problems, Soledad Brother and Blood in My Eye are texts that again, unfortunately, I would like to say that they were no longer necessary for our moment, at least, but they will be excellent additions to people's intellectual canon and guideposts for us to build around.
Sure, indeed. I got about two more questions there. I'm going to let the comrades get in. Okay, I see that you were working with Marsha Ann Conway at the Real News Network, right?
Well, we were. I no longer work there, but we did for a time work together, and he and his colleagues are doing some very good work in Baltimore City and in prisons around the country.
Okay.
By the way, I mean, Marshall Eddie Conway, not only had he served all these, you know, four plus decades in prison, but he has come out with an energy and a brilliance and a fire that is really necessary. So it was an honor to get to work with him while I did. And even more importantly, he's continuing to do some really important work in the Gilmore Homes community in Baltimore and elsewhere.
Okay. My next question is, I heard about your book that you wrote called A Lie Reinvention, Correcting Mary Matter of Malcolm X book. I read some of Mary Emanuel books. I never read your book, right? And what I want to know is, what made you critique this brother book and say it's a lie reinvention?
Well, I'd be as quick as I can. First of all, I just was a co-editor of the book. So I and Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs, who's a brilliant journalist, co-edited the book, and it's a collection of about, 12 or 13 different contributors' essays, people that worked with Malcolm, people that studied with Malcolm, people that legally defended one of his accused killers, people who have organized in his tradition. So it was a good collection of folks. All took different, slightly different approaches to their critique, but essentially, my argument remains that not to disrespect the man himself, Manning Marable, I don't think was the enemy or the problem. What I do think occurred with the final book that he at least nominally produced, and I actually have some suspicions that I can't fully prove. Admittedly, but I just have some suspicions that he really wasn't as involved with the final version of that book as the publisher would like us to believe, in part just because he was struggling so long with a serious illness and died just as the book was finally coming out. But the long story short is that if you read the book carefully and if you understand Malcolm X's history and the people that he worked with and the ideas that he was working with, most notably, radical nationalism, internationalism, socialism, pan-Africanism, a philosophy of armed self-defense, anti-colonialism, et cetera. If you understand that about Malcolm, when you read the book, it basically looks to repackage Malcolm X as someone who would have been more along the lines of a radical Democrat today. And for me, I'll summarize my argument by just saying that if you read the epilogue of the book, where there's some real leaps of logic trying to connect Malcolm X with Barack Obama, and then, of course, Manning Marable's ideological descendant, Peniel Joseph, did the same thing in his work, connecting Barack Obama to Malcolm X, and I've debated him and argued and written against him as well. My argument is really that people, academics like that, and journalists or activists or anyone who tries to repackage someone like Malcolm X to diminish the concepts with which he was working and to remove them from what should be on our sort of buffet table of possible options as we look to figure out our way out of this mess, need to be challenged. That we can't let people just get away with that. So this is not to say that I am the all-knowing expert on Malcolm X or the only one who should speak about Malcolm X. Far from that. What I was just trying to argue is that we are in a moment, and this is it reoccurs. It's not that this is the only time it's ever happened, but we do need to recognize the moment we're in, where there is an attempt to rewrite the history of the civil rights era and the Black Power era to make this moment seem more acceptable, to make this moment seem more like a culmination progressively from those stages of our political struggle political struggle. And I just thoroughly disagree with that. I think Barack Obama is the antithesis to Malcolm X. I think that when Marable, in an attempt to create, or his publishers, in an attempt to create a version of Malcolm X that would sell well to white liberal audiences, which is the target of your bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers list, that you have to present him, as Wendy Wolfe, the publisher, said in her own public lectures and speeches about the book, that she herself was scared of Malcolm X and didn't know or understand Malcolm X and needed her own needed him to be packaged in the kind of way that made her feel okay and less threatened. That's what they were trying to do. So they created, they tried to create a biography of Malcolm X. Now, we don't have time now, and I would encourage people to get our book and feel free to critique us. But the amount of historical inaccuracies, the amount of flat out borrowing without attribution, poor citations, you know, thorough, like, you know, in my essay in the book, I pull out a few examples where Marable fully cuts off Malcolm X quotes and repackages them in certain ways to give us an impression that Malcolm was saying the exact opposite of what he had intended to say or what he did in fact say when he was alive. I mean, there were so many errors in the book, both historically, journalistically, politically, ideologically, that we felt we had to have some sort of response, just to have something out there that clearly challenged what is being presented even to this day as the definitive masterpiece on the life and work of Malcolm X. And it just unfortunately doesn't come close.
Okay. I was just in here one place like a couple of weeks ago. I was looking for that book. Does everyone place have it, or they were just out of stock? Because I know they have a lot of books, and sometimes they don't have them on the shelf. They have them in the catalog.
I'm not sure, but I'm sure you can get them straight from Black Classic Press. So I would encourage people, and yourself included, if you don't mind doing it online, or if it's possible, get it there. Or I don't know, but after that, I will check and see if we can get some more copies over there. They should definitely be in there.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned that aspect of Barack Obama and Malcolm X, because I've seen a lot of like conspiracy theories saying that Malcolm X was Obama's daddy, and you know all this old tomfoolery. It doesn't make any sense to me, right? Like, man, these folks talking about, you know. And the people who's supposed to be done it, but we notable scholars, right? I like, man, you know. It doesn't make any sense in those aspects to put different people or different mind states, different political ideologies, and try to make them equivalent to fit a certain time period like you're doing now, like you're talking about, like fit a certain time period to make things feel uncomfortable, to basically make a lot of our revolutionary heroes and freedom fighters weaker than what they actually were, try to make them weak or seen passive or a servile, you know. That's what it would seem to me. I got one more question. Are you currently working in your local organization in Baltimore, like the Jericho Amnesty, the Black Olive Moore Coordinating Committee, the Gene Progress Party, All for Justice, or any of the organizations locally?
No, I am you know, really woefully inactive politically in Baltimore, or where I was usually more active in D.C. The unfortunate reality is that I'm just more or less at this point a working man and, a chauffeur to my daughters. That's basically a bulk of the where my time goes. I just try to be supportive in terms of some media work and of similar efforts, at least not specifically with those groups, and find maybe other ways to support similar, you know, efforts. But no, I admittedly am not at all active enough.
Okay. I want to thank you again for coming on to broadcast this show and share your wisdom and knowledge and understanding and sharing some of your thoughts. I'm going to say Ashanti Shana. I'm catching the whirlwind. I'm going to pass on to other comrades. Let them get a couple of questions in. I appreciate it, brother.
Thank you very much.
Continue to hold the lines and continue to try to control the most propaganda as possible, man, because we need that.
Yeah, likewise, my man.
Definitely.
I appreciate that.
Sure, indeed.
Definitely. And Bumani, that the book was in everyone's place.
Where it was?
Yeah, it was right on the other side of the counter, man.
Oh, man, I know I was looking for it. I didn't even see it, man. You know, there's so many jewels in there.
Yeah, I'm going to have to send it to you.
Okay. That's what's up. So many jewels.
Yeah, how you
now,
doing,
like,
Judd? This is
Rafi. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I heard you mention earlier that you have done some work with alternative political parties. Could you comment on that, and what role should these parties serve?
Oh, man, it's an interesting time for you to raise that question. I mean, I had been, since I had moved back to D.C. in the early 2000s, I had joined the D.C. Statehood Green Party, and from there had done some work, a little bit briefly as a candidate, but supporting other Green Party candidates. And the argument that I used to, and I really honestly don't know where I am with it tonight, but that I formally was trying to make was that again, along the lines of George Jackson, if we're going to engage in electoral political politics, it needs to be separate from the two state-sponsored corporate capitalist parties, and it need to be a political party that could actually produce candidates that would represent the legitimate revolutionary ideals of the people comprising that party. So that was the effort I was trying. And, you know, I've also done some very limited work trying to support, you know, for instance, the Party for Socialism and Liberation and their candidates, a little bit of the Freedom Party and Peace and Freedom Party in California. But, you know, indirectly, just trying to find ways to support people joining mainstream dominant party electoral political parties. But, you know, honestly, I really don't think we have time for it, and I don't even know much of what to make of it, but, you know, with the whole Jill Stein breaking with Ajamu Baraka and the Green Party to do this recount nonsense, I'm not sure where I stand tonight with that party. I do support the Ujima People's Political Party in Maryland, Nnamdi Lumumba, and you know, the first black worker-led political party in Maryland. You know, I think we should be, you know, to the extent that electoral politics are to be a part of our arsenal of struggle, I just am convinced it has to be outside the two dominant parties, which exists specifically to stifle and suppress, you know, any radical or revolutionary potential associated with the vote. So, but I would like to know what you all think, because honestly, at this point, I really am not sure what our approach should be or how best we should work with these alternative parties. But the point for me, just very quickly, is if electoral political politics is to be part of it, it has to be an alternative, and it has to be something where at some point we're willing to work with a variety of other racial and ethnic groups. If for no other reason, you have to have, you know, the numbers if we're talking about voting. So, but anyway, that's basically what it's been and where I am right now.
Thank you for that, and yeah, I am a part of Ujima UPP. So,
okay,
yeah, I've done a lot of work with Nnamdi and whatnot. And the community has been receptive, you know. Now, of course, we don't have the funds like the bigger parties do. But, you know, it's a way to do above-ground activities and whatnot.
Right on. That's right.
I didn't know if, Bumani, you wanted to comment on that as far as alternative political parties.
Based on my thoughts on that situation, that I look at a political climate right now. I look at a political climate, and America, with three Ks, is actually showing its true face right now. And the same thing that we've been talking about, and Elder before has been talking about, in order to push we're talking about in the struggle and the liberation of our people, it became transparent to a lot of other people now that their political content is awakening. And what I realized is that we need to focus more on ourselves as new African people try to build our nation up before we even consider working with any other parties or any other organizations that are not New African people, right? Yet, I'm going to say that we will. It's gonna come a time that we still need them allies, you know what I'm saying? That we're not racist people, we're not prejudiced. It's to the point that we gotta get ourselves together first before we work with anybody else, which is our main objective. And then, so really, looking at it, you know what I'm saying? A lot of things politically are being pushed and geared to an aspect of racism. And racism itself is just another tentacle of capitalism. And we know capitalism is dying, so they're using all these tricks and schemes to try to carry on the legacy or they control the divide and conquer. And by me saying that, a lot of the racism being geared and promoted a lot, like they try to make a half sucking on a race war. And though we know strategically and numbers, we can't win a race war. We know we can't win that. We can't win it because we don't got the artillery. We don't got the food. We don't got the land resources. We won't win in that aspect. But ultimately, if it comes down to the aspect of a civil war, and all the people that are oppressed from this system join forces, and then when the allies come in, the Chicano, the Latins, the anarchist structures, the white socialists, and all the other groups come about, the Trotskys, and, you know, whoever they might be come about, then we'd be able to move forward. But so that's always my thoughts on the situation.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I'll add to that as well is, you know, even looking overseas in past history, that and even looking at it, we can take it from different examples, even just looking at like the Black Panther Party, you know, or looking at an above-ground organization, any party that's truly progressive but different from the current mainstream party, eventually will probably more likely get outlawed. Because even if the party doesn't have an armed wing, it will still be a problem for the state itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings on to another question. What is your definition of political prison? That's for you, Jared.
Well, I mean, you know, I like all the various definitions I've heard. I mean, essentially, I think we have to start with those who are locked up specifically because of their political work in defense of the liberation of their communities. So that's, you know, but on the other hand, I agree with those who still say that all prisoners are political given the context in which they become prisoners. And I keep thinking of that Dr. King statement where he talked about, you know, he said that, you know, when Black people hurt each other and commit crimes, that's horrible. But he called those, quote, derivative crimes, that they are derivative, you know, they come after the initial crimes of the state, of capital, of white supremacy. So, you know, mm-hmm. in that sense, and in that context, all these people in prison are in some level, or at least a majority of them are, you know, are political prisoners, given the life chances and the violence that they suffered preceding whatever crime that they were convicted for. So, and then when you look at the relationship that the state has with prison and the economy has with incarceration and the history of enslavement and the continuation of enslavement, it's hard not to see it as being that way, in the sense that the prison system as we know it was developed as a necessity post-enslavement to manage populations that had no other role to play in the economy. So, yeah, that's basically it.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see George Jackson in that? Do you see him as that political prisoner that first started off as a criminal and then became aware, or
Well, I mean, officially, that's the story, right? I mean, you know, and even he acknowledged that when he was running around as a young man, young boy in the streets, he was doing a lot of what I think a lot of us were doing, just regular. And I wasn't even in the street, so-called. I was growing up in a Section 8 suburb, but still the same basic young boy, young man logic as we approach the world, just get and with limited so-called options. So, but as he also, as his life example also points out, I mean, you were convicted of a $70 gas station robbery, and you're locked up forever. So, what? And then clearly, not only did he become radically political within the prison system, but it becomes clear that his incarceration is tied to his radicalization and his influence on the movement outside of the prison walls. And then obviously his assassination culminating is because of his politics. He was not assassinated because he once upon a time, 15 years earlier, stole $70 from a gas station. In the same way, you know, that I've argued in the past Dr. King was not assassinated because he cheated on Coretta. That's not to excuse his infidelity, but that's not why he was assassinated. So we have to understand what drives the forces that leads to these assassinations, and it's not anything other than their politics. That people are, you know, these people are not being incarcerated, particularly people like George, not being maintained in prisons. Like today, Kevin Rashid Johnson is a good example of someone who started out in my generation in the 90s in Virginia, and he, as he had says himself, was, you know, caught up in the dope game and all that kind of stuff, but becomes radically politicized in the prison system and is being to this day punished for it. So, and his writings and his arc is very much like, you know, George Jackson and Emory Douglas kind of combined. So, it's just clear that particularly in George's case, he did start off as he said himself, sort of an under-politicized, regular young black man in the United States. And just like what I also think is interesting to note is that what is also a potentially regular occurrence is he became radical and reached some important and scary, and at least for me, scary and uncomfortable logical conclusion, and looked to be and organized around those conclusions, and did become a threat immediately to the prison structure, and then and beyond that.
Indeed. The next question will go on. What role should the media play far as in the liberation struggle, and particularly for political prisoners and political prisoners who, because now we have a generation where people are unaware of, you know, people heard of, you know, the Black Panther Party, but you know, the individuals who are 40, you know, 30, 50s who are in the prison, who have study groups going on. And even at, like, even as George Jackson University, we have brothers from East and West Coast who have progressive movements inside the prison. So what should be the role of the media or individuals yourself that do mixtapes and whatnot, what role should that bring to the struggle?
Well, and unfortunately, I really do hate to say it. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to wrap this up in a few minutes, so I'll try to fold this into some concluding comments. One, I think what you all are doing is exactly what needs to be done. I think, you know, media have ideally, for me, always been best served when part of when serving a political organization. When in, you know, that's the concept of emancipatory journalism, that I've tried to adopt from Hemant Shah, that organizations involved in radical struggle need to be producing their own media and creating their own pundits and creating their own sources and bright line topics, all in service of educating and promoting the work of their organization. And I think that in terms of political prisoners, you know, unfortunately, you know, Sundiata Kolhe is getting old and just lost another bid for parole. Jaleel Muntakeen, who I think is the youngest political prisoner, is himself, you know, looking great and in good health, but aging. And, you know, we're running out of time for that generation's political prisoners. At the same time, we're not adequately, I think, prepared to educate and organize a defense for people who are going to become and who are already becoming political prisoners. And I agree with others who have pointed out, you know, even becoming targets for assassination, including Sandra Bland. So, you know, as people are engaging Black Lives Matter or related struggles for the first time, we saw the same thing happen with Jasmine Richards out west. You know, that the system is creating new political prisoners and targets for, you know, violence. The mysterious occurrences with these brothers in Ferguson. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, and I think that media. What I really struggle with, and I don't know how to do this, is I think we have to better organize all of these alternative media operations and start to create larger hubs and make better use of the Internet to create a larger public sphere. Too many of us are doing this kind of work in isolation or in small groups, and we're not generating the kind of audience that we need, and we're not enough connected with each other's work. And I think that it's limiting our impact. And given the reach of the dominant pervasive media and its ownership and political structure, I think we're losing the battle for reaching the kind of audiences and the numbers in an organized way that we need. So, obviously, I think, again, the kind of work that you're doing specifically creating media for and about prisoners and political prisoners is essential. And we just have to find other ways to better organize it, scale it up so that it is able to compete in some way with the kind of media that many of our young folks are looking for and are attracted to. And then we also have to do better of organizing ourselves politically outside of our media production so that media, the content that we produce has an appropriate home as an audience that can then take the ideas and concepts promoted in that media and make them real. Now, I say all that to say, and I say all that knowing full well that I myself have not been able to figure out how to better make that happen. So I'm not saying that as if I think that I have it fully figured out or that I've been able to make it work. But I do think, at least theoretically, that's where we are and where we need where we need to be.
Indeed. I thank you, and I appreciate that answer. And, you know, you're right on that we do need to somewhat have a bigger hub and need to be more connected, because there's a lot of us actors peppered all over America, and if we could be working better with each other, we could have a better impact. Since time is getting short, I want to make sure that Bumani or Sister Moon, that if they have any I guess closing statements or any last questions to ask you, they can do so now. Sister Moon?
I don't have any questions. I know you say you got to wrap it up in a few, but I appreciate all the information. And, I'm glad that, you got in touch with the right book, even though it wasn't sometimes when you come into awareness of certain things, you painfully come into awareness of certain things. But I think that's you end up going into the right purpose if you take the information and make it your purpose to give it to other people. So that we can start to see changes. Because if what I was thinking about earlier, when I was, I'm sorry, when I was driving earlier, I was thinking how, dang, this lady came in here and just made me lose my train of thought. basically, what I was, the amount of change that we've seen, you know, globally, just in the last, you know, whether that be in a few decades or even in, you know, hundreds of years ago, life changed drastically in like the, you know, in a period of a few days to a few weeks to a few months. So we don't have to accept the things the way they are. So we can, you know, we can start to take measures now and each and every day. And like you said, the bigger the platform, we change. So I appreciate appreciate everything that you said.
No, thank you very much, and I definitely hope that we can all stay connected, and this will be, you know, the first of several conversations. And I do invite you all and your listeners to check out, you know, we have something building at imixwhatilike.org, and the kind of media hub that we're talking to, that I mentioned. We are looking to in the next few months, some comrades of mine and I are going to try to create. Put our money where my mouth has been this last mm-hmm. hour, and to try to help develop that kind of hub and bring folks like yourselves in so that the, you know, we can, you know, again make better use of the internet and put into practice a little bit of what we were talking about. So I will be continuing to look for you all and again, I appreciate you, man. I appreciate the linking up and the work that you all do. And you having me on this hour.
True indeed, but I'm gonna say I look forward to developing a relationship with you and working with you and your endeavors and we both accomplishing what we need to accomplish in this struggle and liberation. And I applaud you and your efforts for maintaining and try to control as much of the propaganda as possible, okay, needed strategically for us to get our point across to our people. Needed to control the propaganda is a level of strategic communication that we need to free our mind, which free our people, and get to them really to see what's really going on instead of seeing all their propaganda.
Okay.
And I appreciate it, bro. You know, again, for coming onto this show and sharing your thoughts.
Hey, man, anytime. And I greatly appreciate being invited on and to being a little bit more exposed to the work you all are doing. So let's definitely connect and going into next semester, let's see if we can't connect with some of my students too. So let's stay in touch. And again, I thank you all very much. And we'll catch you soon. Catch you, like you said, in the whirlwind.
True indeed, bro.
In the world. All right, take care,
sweet
everybody.
Man.
Peace.
By any means. Peace, bro.
And this concludes our show today. We want to thank all our listeners who's out there who listen every Wednesday, and then to our comrades in the sea and on land. Stay strong. Mo Jehuba.
One love, comrade.
Peace and power.
You know what gang violence is, mostly, and the people don't want you to hear this? Somebody shoots your family member, so of course you retaliate. You know what I mean? Same thing the U.S. does, except nobody even shot their family members. You know, they see somebody bomb a school and all these people get killed, so the United States feel like, ooh, that's messed up, we got to go show them who's the real killer. This country was built on gangs. You know, I think this country still is run on gangs, Republicans, Democrats, the police department, the FBI, the CIA, those are gangs. You know what I mean? The correctional officers. I had a correctional officer tell me straight up, we the biggest gang in New York State. Straight up.
The president revolution up from meditating team, introducing drugs all crap to us ghetto teams. Got a lot for war niggas now, play of what it be like. When will niggas see they got us leading with three strikes? Can't seem to focus, hopeless, with violent thoughts I wrote this. Got the devil petrified, hot from my heart to focus. And so I learned to earn my currency in overtime.
affiliated, clearly click a military mob. May God forgive us, so we dwell inside a paradox. Thugged out and drug dealing from the womb to the block. My live mind got me surviving 5 rounds. My 45 got me fortified with live rounds. When shit kick, we block hit. Or I drop stick, all hell, I don't bail, wrath, the apocalypse. Forever ghetto necessary, keep the food stamp. Outlaw thug niggas never left the food stamp.
We got a real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world who rock to that.
DJ
from my soldiers to death, when I fuck my soldiers to death, from my soldiers to death, we got the real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world who rock to that, when my soldiers to death, from my soldiers to death, when I fuck my soldiers to death, from my soldiers to death.
Now I was born as a rebel, making trouble for the devil, take this gangbang shit to a whole nother level. Can you feel me now? Armies in every city, definition of power. Players, are you ready to see the war? It's the prophecy, survival is the strategy. Rest in peace to my comrades, that's the seat. Organize the streets in time, yeah, any devil petrified of a nigga in his right mind. They tell us that we hopeless and hellbound. It's for the brothers and penitentiary jail, bam. I got you in my heart till the day I die. Think of the damage we could do if we wasn't high. Can you picture me low? It's the thug rap. Political contracts and bloodbath. From a Tulsa core up in the rockets, though they got you. I never let them stop me, the struggle continues.
Now, if we do want to live a thug life and a gangster life and all of that, okay, so stop being cowards and let's have a revolution. But we don't want to do that. Dudes just want to live a character. They want to be cartoons. But if they really wanted to do something, they was that tough. All right, let's start our own country. Let's start a revolution. Let's get out of here. Let's do something.